COO, San Francisco, Bible Bible.
Shiva Shiva. Shiva Shiva. Shiva Shiva.
Let me in.
Shiva Shiva.
I want to be closer to you.
Shiva Shiva.
Open up your soul.
Shiva Shiva.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
love. Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, understand something. It's the first Monday of the month, and that means scintillating science. And I have a science envoy, a science ambassador here to talk to you and fill your mind with lovely, lovely science. I'd like to welcome my science ambassador, Ruthie Fouché. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being. So Ruthie, tell the listening audience what your brand of science is.
So my field specifically is developmental psychology. So that's the study of how humans change and learn across the lifespan. And then I more specifically study how kids learn language and how we use that. Yeah.
That's awesome. So when did you first discover that you were interested in science?
I think it was mainly discovering what the words were to express to other people that what I was interested in was science. My sister and I always made up languages as...
Hello? Yeah. Oops. Looks like we are having some issues. I'm guessing that the issues are related to fires and whatnot, so we'll probably be having these issues in and out. So we're gonna rejoin Ruthie in just a few minutes. And in the meantime, let us enjoy a little bit of Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox. Okay, we've got Ruthie Fouché back on the line, and she was just about to tell us about her and her sister making up languages. Before we go on, we know that there's fires raging throughout, California's basically on fire, and so the power grid's going to be in and out, and we can all roll with that. So let's everybody we're going to listen, and we're going to enjoy, and it is what it is, to quote a famous bard. So Ruthie, you were telling me about how when you were little, you and your sister would make up a language. Do you remember the first language you guys made up?
Yeah, one of the early ones, which is incredibly, a very poor language, was just the word prickly pear over and over again, and all of the meaning was carried in the sort of intonation. So if you said prickly pear really urgently or really loud, you know, that was a sort of emergency call. Uh-huh. But then a more useful one was a sort of system of hand signals that was used to indicate to one another when we were at a party with grown-ups that we needed to be extracted from a long conversation about how school was.
I love it, but I love the fact that your first language involved tonality, which I don't know if English-speaking people necessarily tune into that.
Yeah. I think people really don't realize that we do explicitly, but if you sort of listen to you can imagine the same sort of, you can imagine a compliment, for example, said sincerely versus sarcastically, the only difference, the words are the same, the only difference is that intonation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely something that is part of our meaning-making system, even in English.
Okay, so your first language, we're going to call it prickly pear, and we're going to leave it with that.
Yeah.
So then so then you made up more languages. Was there a structure to it, or was it just you guys saying, oh, when I say this word, it means this, and when I say this word, it means that?
They got increasingly structured, right, as we sort of developed, and also our needs, our communicative needs developed, so we found ourselves in more situations where we wanted to have a sort of secret signaling system.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in life, we made up languages that were specifically filling gaps that we felt like where English was insufficient. And so sort of like more fine-grained words for emotions,
mm-hmm.
or for smells, or... sort of how we felt about different things. So these things that I think all of us find really difficult to express in any language, but what if there were a language that were just for that?
Right. I remember thinking, wow, the Germans seem to have a word, like when you discover the word Schadenfreude, you just assume that, oh, wow, well, the Germans have really nailed getting those words. Like, I want there to be a word for the thing that you do that you normally avoid doing, but you're doing it to avoid doing something else. I wish there were a word for that, because I've been doing that a lot lately. It's like, oh, well, I hate cleaning the house, but I'd much rather clean the house than work on this thing. And vice versa.
Totally. Yeah. So the most recent iteration of the languages is one that does capture these sort of fine-grained emotions, like you're talking about. It's really compositional. So it has, you add up little pieces of meaning to get new bigger meanings. So the adding up pieces would be something like, the word for recursive or like repeated, mm-hmm. and then pushing away for that maybe.
Oh. We're going to have to come back to that, because I definitely want a word. So you're going for. So at what point did you find out that what you and your sister were doing could actually be scientifically studied and codified?
Well, so I think as with many, 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 many people, it was due to an incredible teacher in high school. And I took this amazing class where you got to design your own research project, and it was really unstructured. And it was just and most magically, we had access, so I'm from Arizona, we had access to the University of Arizona's library system.
Mm-hmm.
And through sort of searching the things that I was interested in, I discovered that there were other people like me, and they were called linguists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could study this. There was so much structure to this, like, domain of knowledge that I've been sort of amateurly taking notes on for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did this first project, another one of the sort of childhood observations about language was that whenever grown-ups wanted to, when they were, like, making a joke or they were telling a story, and they were wanting to introduce a character who was stupid,
uh-huh.
They would use a Southern accent. And I was really fascinated by this because it didn't seem like the Southern accent, the like way that the sounds went, right, had any relation to what it seemed like uniformly they were trying to convey.
Uh-huh.
And this is true in children's media, and in radio stories. And it seemed like it was sort of really robust way that everyone understood this to be signaling something about the personality of the speaker. Anyway. And so in this high school class, I had different speakers of different dialects of English read the same passages of Harry Potter over the phone to a bunch of random adult subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And then the adult subjects judged them on all of these different dimensions. And so that was the first time that I got this really satisfying experience of having a sort of hunch and then designing a sort of setup that would make me able to get evidence to speak to that hunch, and then in this case, validating it. So adults, when they listen to the Southern speaker reading the exact same passage, they couldn't see the speaker, they judge them more frequently as foolish and other sort of related words.
Interesting. You know, it makes sense because whenever, like, Gomer Pyle was based on, like, the dumb Southern hick, you know, but always kind of outsmarting through stupidity the more worldly people. And, you know, Beverly Hillbillies, there are all these shows where the Southern accent is just sort of the shorthand for dumb.
Precisely. And I think it's a way of signaling that we're a lot less tuned into. Mm-hmm. And it's like a sort of dimension of diversity that I think it's really easy to lose sight of. But if you actually sort of take a moment to think about how similar the people that you interact with in a daily way sound, mm-hmm. and then think about what actual enormous diversity there is among English speakers, you realize that this is like another way in which we are in frequently homogenous environments and media, right? Most people have very similar sounding accents.
Mm-hmm. So you designed this experiment, and I'm assuming you got an A on it, and you just sort of ran from there. But when you discovered that it was called, that you could be a linguist, did you run to your sister? Because you two of you had been doing this all your life. Did you be like, guess what? This, you know, there's this thing called linguistics, and we're doing it.
I mean, I ran to everyone. I was screaming it from the rooftop. Are you kidding me? It was such a revelation. It was so exciting. Reading about all of the different subfields, and I read just sort of random essays, because I didn't have any of the sort of, you know, literature review skills, mm-hmm. didn't know how to refine my search. So I read very random and sort of helter-skelter things about linguists and about what they did and what they were good at and what they were interested in, and I was just salivating the whole time.
But that's the beauty of being young, is you don't have this sort of preconceived structure of how to learn, so maybe you get exposed to more things than if you had that structure in place. So what was one of the things that you read that really impressed you?
There's this essay by this sociolinguist, mm-hmm. and that's the field that I was sort of doing this study in, where he said, you know, the one thing that you need to be good at linguistics, and this is, you know, his brand of linguistics, is that you have to want to talk to everyone.
Mm.
And that was incredibly appealing and seemed exactly right, and like really jived with how much time I had spent up until then, not only talking to people, but just, you know, listening and taking notes on how they use language in all of these ways beyond what we typically think about as, as what it's for.
So are you one of those people that strikes up conversations with strangers?
You are, aren't you?
You are.
I think I will become more sort of sinfully, I'm one of those people who is just a compulsive eavesdropper.
Oh, okay.
If that weren't the case. but I think that it's cleaner language data, you know, if mm-hmm. you're not involved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So fast forward, you're off to college. Do you jump right into linguistics, or do you take a more circuitous route?
Oh, 100%. I had to be told, I think, in my sophomore year, that I needed to slow down on taking linguistics classes because I was going to end up with kind of like 2 degrees in linguistics and then none of the general education requirements.
Ah.
So I was super hungry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm guessing then the university that you chose had a very robust linguistics department. Did you choose your college based on their linguistics department?
I didn't. I chose it based on, so I went to Harvard and I just saw pictures of it. I didn't visit before I went. And it just looked a lot like Harry Potter. and that was, you know, that was pretty enticing at that mm-hmm. particular juncture in my life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What I love about that is, like, when you think about it, we all kind of make decisions based on not necessarily the most logical things, but they work. They end up working. So you go in, you're doing the linguistics thing, and then how do you focus in on the way children learn languages?
Yeah, so I was also a kid who always babysat. When I turned 12, and that was the age that you needed to take the CPR training course,
mm-hmm.
I immediately took it, you know, on like the day after my birthday, and then I sent out a mass letter to all of the people with children that I knew.
You're adorable.
Saying, you know, now I'm CPR certified. Now you can like pay me basically for what I've already been doing for you, which is having an amazing time with your kids. So in college, I saw a job posting that just seemed like any other like work study job
mm-hmm.
that I thought was for a daycare. And that seemed like one of the rare things that I was quite qualified for. And it turned out to be a developmental psychology lab. And that was way funner, way cooler. And it turned out that like I could do the like sort of phone call studies,
uh-huh.
But with way more constraints and with way sillier research participants.
I love it. So do you remember the first sort of research thing you conducted in that job?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because this was, so the first research thing was looking at how kids acquire the meanings of left and right. This is like one of the things that, of course, like many adults actually don't have it totally down,
mm-hmm.
but it's one of the things that it takes a really long time to master. And so to design an experiment to access kids' understanding of left and right and how much they're sort of tracking those consistently, this study involved a rubber ducky glued to a sort of god's eye of Tinker Toys.
Uh-huh.
So two cross-sected Tinker Toy holes, and then on one side of the ducky there was a little box that you would hide something in,
mm-hmm.
And then then you would spin the ducky, and so you could only find the place that you'd hidden the item
mm-hmm.
if you actually remembered, according to the ducky's perspective, the left and right location
okay.
of the item.
That sounds complicated.
It sounds complicated, and then the cool, cool, cool thing is that when you're interacting with it, it's incredibly intuitive for adults. It's really intuitive for kids that you hide something and you want to find it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are all of these other sort of, again, constraints on the experimental design process that I learned through the course of this first study that were just really fun problems to solve. So kids have really strong color preferences, so you can't, you know, make any of the boxes where you hid the items too much of like kids' favorite colors.
Mm-hmm.
But you also needed them to be exciting enough that they were actually had their attention turned to them. So that was like a fun balance. You needed to have a design that didn't require a ton of language to understand. So okay. Again, like, you know, you could explain this whole study silently, and you would still get the same information from a child, from a speaker of any other language, about whether they were tracking things relative to the ducky's perspective
Got
or relative
it.
To their own perspective.
Nice. And so what did you learn from that study?
I learned that it takes English-speaking kids till they're like six and up to sort of reliably solve this task.
Mm-hmm.
And then the really other cool opportunity that I had was to work with speakers of this Mayan language in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
where they reliably use sort of north-south style terms to describe spatial locations rather than left-right. And mm-hmm. so I got to go do this exact same study because it was designed for it to be sort of like language independent, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got to go do this exact same study in Mexico, and show that, you know, kids there did, by default, use more, like, were disinclined to reason from the ducky's perspective, to use the sort of, like, left-right reasoning.
Really? Because they have the north, south, east, west, so did you have to alter the, I guess you weren't trying to find out if they understood north, south, east, west. You were just trying to find out left, right. And so they were like, no, we're not into it.
Well, so we did with both the English-speaking kids and actually adults as well, and the speakers of this language, Beltal. We did the same study, and you would hide things in a location either that was constant across, like according to the broader environment, so always on the north side of something,
mm-hmm.
or this sort of quote unquote egocentric spatial relations, so like left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, what we found is that both groups of speakers could, with a lot of training, do both types of reasoning,
mm-hmm.
but you would see greater rates of errors in the system of spatial reasoning that was less familiar to them.
Interesting. So there's a cultural component to being able to do certain types of linguistic things.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think there's a cultural component to, most of what we're doing when we're talking.
Okay. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. It's Scintillating Science Monday. We're speaking with Ruthie Fouché, who is, she's going for her PhD in psychology, and you're talking about children and linguistics. Now, you mentioned that, or we talked about how you and your sister made up languages. Now, do you find that that is something that is common? Because I, being an only child, still made up my own language with my own letters just because I wanted prettier letters. So is that something that a lot of children do?
I think it's quite common. Yeah, I think it just lasted longer for me, and that was still me, mm-hmm. differentiating thing.
Okay. Do you think it lasted longer because you and your sister had a good relationship, so communication was fabulous? Because I can't imagine siblings who fight developing a language to communicate with one another.
I mean, you still, as a kid, don't actually have all the words that you would want to be properly rageful at someone. So it was still useful to come up with a new system of signs. But yeah, definitely having an interlocutor, having somebody that I always wanted to talk to, and I think just in terms of keeping me really fixated on how remarkable it is,
mm-hmm.
that talking to one another works as well as it does. My sister has been really informative for me because I can say half a word and she gets so much meaning. And if I said half that word to somebody in line at the grocery store, they would just double look at me. So that just seemed like over and over again, I was getting this evidence that like a lot of what we're doing when we're talking is not about the words we're using. In our relationship, our style of communication gave me a ton of evidence of that.
Right. And plus, because you have this history, you can use these types of shorthand. Like, I remember, like, a friend of mine, we were talking about the clothespin people, and we knew exactly what we were talking about because it was a long story behind it. But just those little shorthand things of, like, they say this and you say that. So going back to children and how they learn languages. So what study are you doing as we speak?
So one of the things that also coming from this sort of joint perspective of having just loved so many hours with kids, talking to kids, having so much fun trying to figure out what in the world they were saying, and then also having this sort of linguistics background, one of the things that I've really interested in was how much it seemed like adults sort of like had this idea of that we teach kids to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of like, there's all this emphasis, right, on talking to your kids and sort of framing language as nutrition. And so this like sort of idea that you're spoon feeding the kid words.
Mm-hmm.
And having spent time with kids, that seemed like at least woefully missing some really cool stuff that kids were doing.
Like what?
And then, so one of the big things that I have spent a lot of time researching is kids learning from speech that's around them. So I mentioned eavesdropping earlier, but basically the amount that kids learn new words just from listening to the speaking adults that's in their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of testing those new words out. So another, my sister connection, but I remember really vividly her when she was like 5 or something, coming into the kitchen and thrusting her index finger into the air and saying, "My finger is contaminated." And then she like sort of looked around to see all of our response, because she was using a word that she had overheard somebody else use and seeing if she was using it in the right way.
Mm.
And we sort of all looked at each other and were like, you know, she was a sort of pig pen type of kid. And so we were like, "I don't know if you totally know what you're saying, but like, yeah, it's not wrong." And so all of these ways in which kids were really active participants in their own language learning, and these like all of these little bits of evidence that I saw that kids were actually doing a lot of scavenging of words in their environments and not just taking the ones that adults sort of directed to them or taught them explicitly.
So what? So when you say scavenging, like what sorts of things are they scavenging?
Well, so I mean, my favorite example, because I think it's really vivid, is little kids swearing. So there are these, if you sort of search, you know, where did my toddler learn to curse, you get tons and tons and tons of search results and parents sort of comforting one another. And it's like, well, for the most part, those particular items that they picked up weren't necessarily directed to them, right? But they were around them,
mm-hmm.
and they thought that this string of sounds was interesting. And started using it, and largely using it correctly. So this sort of like tuning into conversations around them, and then using those new words and sort of refining their knowledge of them.
And getting a rise, and so it's like, oh, well, this is a good word because it gets a good reaction.
100%. Yeah, with swearing in particular, there's a very delicious for a kid feedback loop, I think.
Mm-hmm. Adults too.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
All right, so you're working with children, and I'm just going to relate a story to you because it's always amused me. I was on the bus, and there was this father, and he was with his little son. His son was probably 3, and you could tell that they just doted on one another. And the child was fascinated with motorcycles, but he pronounced it Mokotaito. And so the dad was trying to teach him how to say it properly. So he said, "Say motor," and he said, "Motor," and he said, "Say cycle," and he said, "Cycle," and he says, "Motorcycle," and the kid goes, "Motokaiko," and I just was like, "Oh, it was just so adorable." So, in learning words and stuff, how do you correct for the way children's inability to say certain words at a certain? How do you correct for that when you're doing your study?
Oh, that's interesting. So when they're responding, how do you correct for the fact that they might not be able to pronounce something totally spot on?
Yeah, because how some parents know exactly what their kids are saying and you have no idea what they're saying.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so that really is part of the, to my mind, really exciting design challenge of these experiments. If you try to the best of your abilities to make it so that the kid could basically go through it silent, right, and just pointing.
Mm-hmm.
And you've constructed the setup so that you're getting information about their language knowledge,
mm-hmm.
without it being constrained by the things like, you know, what they're able to pronounce at that particular juncture.
So what's the age range that you study?
So my deep love age range are 3-year-olds.
Okay.
And I always say, like, I like 3-year-olds because for the first 2 years, it seems like parents are able to sort of maintain this illusion that they are, like, making something, you know? And then it's, like, around the 3rd birthday where they realize that, like, oh, my gosh, there's just something growing in my house. and it is its own thing.
Right.
And, of course, you know, they love it and all of that, but just, like, they're not crafting something.
Right. This thing has its own personality.
Yeah. So it's a lot of stuff with 3-year-olds and then all the way up through like 10-year-olds.
Okay. So you're starting at 3 and you're going to 10. So what would you say are some of the linguistic milestones that aren't necessarily linguistic milestones that maybe you as an adult don't understand, but you kind of recognize that, oh, something's happened here?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the things that I've spent a lot of time researching is kids developing understanding of words that are totally subjective. So things like, you know, you and I could disagree about whether something's beautiful, and any adult would say, okay, well, you know, you both, because of how the word beautiful or pretty or whatever works, both of you can be right.
Mm-hmm.
But most things don't work like that, right? One of us has to be correct. And it takes kids a really long time, like, you know, into middle of elementary school, to arrive at the same conclusion that adults express very readily, which is that for some types of words, both people, even if they're totally contradicting one another, can, in the exact same world, be correct. So that's one that's, like, very fun also for parents to, if you just try out disagreeing with a kid and or ask them to explain why they think that something is, for example, pretty, they will just rely on, they'll speak as if prettiness is a property of an object in the same way that being red or being light up or whatever is. And then once you get into later ages, kids will start saying, oh, well, you know, this person is expressing an opinion, and that's something about how the word pretty works. Both people can be right.
Okay, and when does that happen? When children, so you say it's somewhere in elementary school, but are we talking, like, you know, are we talking first grade, are we talking third grade, are we talking, does it matter if they are interacting with other kids or homeschooled, or is it the same across the board?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I am trying to figure out right now, because obviously if you scale this up to grown-ups and you think about sort of bigger disputes and how often we pretend, how often the these like really big political debates are actually end up being these debates over a word's definition. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, you think about like the debate about what socialism is or, you know, abortion or what counts as a fetus is another sort of definitional debate, but where we're using language to negotiate something way bigger. And so I have studies now looking at, you know, does being bilingual, does that give you the ability to sort of reason a bit more about language as an object, like sort of from the outside, that might make it more intuitive that some words don't actually have, you know, fixed meaning, but depend on their speaker. So I don't know yet.
All right.
What the answer to that is, but it is somewhere around third grade.
Okay. Now that the you mentioned bilingual, so I have bilingual nieces and nephews, and when they were, you know, very young, if I spoke to them in Spanish, they would respond in Spanish, and if I spoke to them in English, they would respond in English. So, how does having this sort of mixed set of languages play? How does that shape a child? Is it, because I've read that children who are bilingual take longer to learn the language, but that they are actually much better with languages when they finally do. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, totally. So one of the things that's really cool is that if you sort of test a kid who's growing up bilingual vocabulary in, for example, just English, along with all of their other classmates who, let's say, are learning English exclusively, so who are monolingual, it'll look like the bilingual kid has a way lower vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you are able to do the exact same vocabulary test in both of their languages and sort of merge all of the concepts that they have words for, you'll see that they're actually just totally on track. It's just that their sort of conceptual repertoire and their vocabulary is split across these two systems.
Okay.
And
go on. Okay, so then here's another question about it's very windy where you are. So here's another question about being bilingual is how do children, I mean, they seem to do it very well, but how are they able to navigate and to understand that, oh, well, when this person is speaking, you know, when they say shark, I should respond this way. And when they say tiburon, I should respond this way. How do they do it? Because that just seems like genius to me.
Yeah, I mean, one, it is totally genius. Two, it is a genius of the same variety that we exhibit every single day. Again, like related to the, my sister and I can say half a word and get some of the meaning out of it.
Mm-hmm.
We factor in like who's talking so much when we are interpreting language, spoken language. And that is, it seems like maybe one of the reasons why kids really prefer often. I don't think that there isn't evidence that it is actually better for them, but they seem to have a preference for one parent, for example, using one language reliably and the other parent using another language.
Okay.
But there does seem to be the kids very early on have the same set of intuitions that adult bilingual speakers have, which is that, you know, these refer to the same concepts and I'm just going to use whichever ones I can reach fastest to get across my meaning.
Got it. So it is 12:37 here at 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. It's Scintillating Science Monday. We're speaking with Ruthie Fouché from UC Berkeley, my alma mater. So I'm always happy to talk to someone from Cal. So when you are doing these experiments and studies, I'm sure because you're working with adorable kids, there have been just some really, like, you know, the kind of interactions that get you through a tough day. Like, you can just pull it out of your head and just be like, just puts a smile on your face. So what is an interaction you've had with some of your test subjects that really just warm you to this day?
Yeah, so let me think about that. So I had one really memorable kid who I was asking for, it was this sort of like graded study where it got a little bit trickier to answer the questions as it went on.
Mm-hmm.
And like 3/4 of the way in, I asked her another question and she said, "I don't know, I'm just a kid." But it was like very clearly just to get out of the situation.
Okay.
I had a study with puppets where a kid, you know, was really, really, really reluctant to participate. And these were Sesame Street puppets. And so I was like, you know, well, maybe do we want to rename the puppets? And they said, yeah. I said, okay, so what was to be named this one? And they said, you know, Mother Mary. I was like, okay. And then, you know, what should we name this one? And they said, Joseph. And then I pointed to the third puppet, and I knew what they were going to name it. I said, okay, so what should we name this one? And I was already starting to rearrange the puppets because I already knew what the answer was going to be. And they said, Mother Butterfly.
Aww.
And I was like, okay. There are a million wonderful things that come out in these studies.
Mm-hmm.
And things that, like, parents have such a good time witnessing, right, in the kids, because they're getting to see all of this cool stuff that they didn't realize the kids already knew or still hadn't quite mastered, but have been sort of pretending that they had down.
Okay, so what would you say is something that you discovered about child development that isn't readily apparent to most people that kind of blew your mind?
I think that, I mean, I think I'm not sure how obvious this is all the time,
mm-hmm.
but I think that how robustly true it seems to be that kids are always listening and kids are always watching us, how much the really rough answer for, I just taught developmental psychology, and I had a few students who are parents, and they would ask me over and over again questions along the lines of, you know, okay, if I don't want my kid to grow up to be sexist. I don't want my kid to grow up to be racist. Like, what do I do? What phrases do I say to them? And it's like, oh, man, I'm so sorry because this is the hardest answer, but it is the only real one, which is like, you got to not be sexist.
Right.
But just like, they really do learn from what we're modeling, and that is both gorgeous and also, something we have to be conscious of.
Mm-hmm. Just like a little simple thing, like if you always say thank you to your partner, then when you see children interacting, they say thank you. Or, I just remember watching a child greet a friend, and she was 4 years old, and she's like, you look very pretty today. And the other girl said, thank you, so do you. And it's like, I looked at it, and I was like, that's what your parents do all the time, isn't it? They're just, constantly doing these little, saying sweet things to one another, and then that's what you do.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. You see, like, there are also, tons of amazing examples of that when you're doing studies. So I had, like, a little 3-year-old boy tell me, those are glorious golden sandals, right? And
oh.
It's like, wow, that was a glorious demonstration of vocabulary and, like, social prowess.
I love that. So what other things have children just sort of wowed you with, things that have fallen out of their mouths?
I think like when I'm doing a study on subjective language, mm-hmm. there are kids who are able to articulate these really profound things. So they'll say, we're all living in the same world, but with his eyes, he sees X, and with her eyes, she sees Y. Or ways in which you see them sort of reach for what I'm choosing to interpret as like metaphors. So mm-hmm. there's a great example of a little boy saying, there's a fire truck in my stomach. And I think, but like one of the reasons why I like examples like that mm-hmm. is that I think as adults, if we're going in with the belief that kids are cognitively, sort of way behind us, which of course they are in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. But they can't possibly be using language poetically at this point, or they can't possibly be making a joke. Of course, we're going to interpret what they say as a mistake, but I think that there are these examples where if you go in with the assumption that they're using language in the same way we do, mm-hmm. which is really elastically, then you hear the fire truck in my stomach, and you're like, that's not an error. That's a kid saying that maybe they're angry or they have a tummy ache, but something much more figurative.
They're designing their own metaphors. Got it. So are there any things linguistically that children are able to do that they lose as they get older?
I mean, we lose the ability. Well, it gets much, much, much harder for us to hear distinctions, phonetic sound distinctions in other languages. So mm-hmm. you mentioned tonal languages at the beginning, right? And that's a sort of famous example of if you're coming from a language without a tone system and going to learn a language with a tone system, it's really hard to hear the differences.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things we sort of, that perceptual ability atrophies with time. And that's really, it's like also important to note that that's not functional. So if you are hearing all of these distinctions that aren't actually useful in your language, you're really slowed down in the task of figuring out, where the words are in a continuous stream of speech. What is like sort of normal variability for how a given word in your language sounds,
mm-hmm.
Presents, or what is enough, sufficiently variable that you should like mark it as a new word. Anyway, so we lose these sort of the ability to sort of like equally perceive differences across languages. And then I think that there's also you could frame this as losing or gaining. But we definitely a big part of the story of kids learning language is also them sort of being socialized into speakers. Mm-hmm. And so they are also losing some flexibility about how to participate in, they're getting socialized to be participants in our particular speech culture. Mm-hmm. So like the kids that you're mentioning who are doing the back and forth compliments, you know, they're learning to do this adult-like thing, but that ends up being, you know, quite constraining, maybe.
Okay. So, and I had a question, and it just fell out of my brain. So, when you're talking with, so one of the things I've noticed with little children is they all sound like they're from New York. They all kind of talk like this. And so, how long is that? Is that something that's sort of universal that they all sound like they're, you know, they have a Bronx accent, or is that just something that's limited to English speakers? And when does that change?
I love that question. It doesn't. I'm not sure if I have noticed though that my niece has a sort of a southern-ish accent and talks really loud. So she just expends a lot of energy when she's pronouncing words.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe the answer, regardless of what particular surprising accent they present with early on, based maybe on the regional dialect that they're aiming for, those sort of like constraints on their production are easing up, certainly in like the 4 to 6 range.
Okay. And are there certain, do you primarily study English speakers, or do you do more of a sort of a global study of people of all different types of languages?
So at Berkeley, I study primarily English speakers, yeah. And then I also have continued to work with this Mayan language in Mexico. So really those two main camps.
That's interesting. So, okay, I'm going to come back to the Mayan thing in just a bit. But so linguistically, when children are learning how to structure a sentence, what's the first way that they kind of do it, and then what do they have to learn to graduate to a more like a regular way?
Yeah, so these sorts of patterns are pretty robust across. Okay, well, certainly it's robust across English.
Mm-hmm.
Kids sort of typically are uttering only one or two words at a time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And them uttering only one word includes words that for us are two words and for them are maybe one. So like, you know, pick up or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so the really cool thing about that in terms of just thinking about how constrained they probably are in terms of getting out sounds, but how much more is going on inside that we don't have as easy access to, is that when they do only produce single words at a time, it seems like they're typically producing the most useful word. So they're not saying, in a sentence like, I'm extremely hungry. They're not saying I or am or extremely. They're just saying hungry.
They cut to the chase.
They don't understand. Yeah, exactly. So then they start having longer and longer utterances, and they're at the very end start putting in words like the and adding plural markers, so making things, you know, fishes and not just fish.
Okay. And is there?
But they observe word order all along.
So is there a common mistake that young children make that takes sort of a long time for them to grasp how to do it properly? Is there a common linguistic mistake?
So it depends on the language, because it depends on what sort of distinction in the language would be hard to figure out just by listening, right? Because they aren't taught in the way that we're taught second languages.
Well, let's take English. Is there a common linguistic error that English speaking children make that it just sort of gets corrected over time?
Yeah. So there's this phenomenon called overgeneralization. That's one of them. So that's where they overregularization. So they will take a word that actually has an irregular, you know, past tense, like ran,
mm-hmm.
right? And they'll make it sound like any other verb, so they'll say run.
Got it.
Right? Then I think those, these are like really, those just sound like little kid words.
They'll also add plurals, add like the S plural to words that shouldn't have it. So mouses, fishes, whatever.
But that's good because it shows that they actually understand, you know, the common way that language is structured. They just don't understand these exceptions yet.
100%. Yeah. And so that's what was in the early history of the study of language development. That was actually one of the primary pieces of evidence that researchers used to show that kids did have this sort of like abstract generalized knowledge of grammar, because there's no way that they had heard rund and fishes, but they were making them. And they were making them because they had like heard all of these other things where you added D or S, and then they'd just done it.
Interesting. And then so tell me a little bit about Mayan language, and because I don't think I've ever heard anyone speak the Mayan language. So are there how is it structured? Is it similar in structure to Germanic languages or English languages tell me about the language.
Yeah. So the particular language that I work on, which is called Tzeltal, is not terribly similar to English. Uh-huh. English is sort of famously one of the things that it seems like might make it easier for adult speakers to learn, for like second language speakers to learn, is that we have very little morphology. We have a past tense, sure, and we have a plural, sure. But for the most part, we say our verbs don't have that many different forms. If you think about like learning another language and all the different conjugation forms, you talk about Spanish, right? And you have forms for who and ustedes and whatever. English has very little of that.
Okay.
And Tzeltal has, so we say I ran, you ran, they ran, she ran, he ran, we ran. Those are all the exact same word. Tzeltal has this just gorgeous system of all of these little pieces that you add together to get across these different aspects of, for example, who it is that's doing an action, whether they're doing it with you or without you, whether they're doing it multiple times, how many times, and that'll all be in what we would call like one word.
And did that blow your mind just in seeing that, because that's not something that you, those permutations aren't something you run across in, say, Romance languages or Germanic languages, correct?
Correct. And I guess like the specific thing that I was just really excited by, because this was one of the things that I had put into some made-up language, you know, in elementary or middle school, was that there is this verbal plurality that I mentioned. So you say, when you pluralize a verb, there's a way of doing it that's indicating how many times you, for example, jumped. And that was just really exciting, and it was going to be so specific.
Wow. So do you remember any of those in the last few minutes?
Any particular verbs?
Like you made this language with, you said they're a word depending on how many times you've jumped.
Oh yeah. So I'm saying like you add these markers. So you add like the sound "deek," the syllable "deek," to part of a verb root in Tzeltal to indicate that you jumped multiple times. If you think about it again, like you think about trying to do in one word in English, doesn't work.
Yeah.
I jumped. yeah.
Well, you know, Ruthie, it's been I could talk to you forever, because I just find linguistics and the children, the two of them together, is like a Reese's peanut butter cup. It's like two great tastes that go great together. So if people wanted to find out more about your research, how would they go about doing that?
So I do have a website, and I'm also on Twitter, Ruthie.Fouché.
And spell that for our listening audience who may not know.
R-U-T-H-E, F as in Frank, O-U, S as in Sam, H-E-E.
All right. Well, Ruthie Fouché, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful, and I'm glad that the power worked out.
I'm glad, too. We got really lucky. All right. So, people of Earth, language, children, it's all fabulous. I'm going to leave you with a Rat Pack version of Bruno Mars's That's What I Like, and you can enjoy it. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta, and toodly-doo.
I got a condo in Manhattan. Baby girl, what's happening? You and your ass invited, so go on, get to clapping. Go pop it for a player, pop it for me. Turn around and drop it for a player, drop it for me.